Salve citizens, I am Oscarius Tabularis, and this is an evening with glimpses into the Empire. Thank you for joining me high in the mountains on this darkest night for a very special performance. This is our first ever live performance of our fan-submitted segment to the Emmy Award-winning Miskatonic University podcast. I'd like to thank the organizers of the Carnage community, the Carnage Convention, for this opportunity and for the work they do supporting our community. This is a very special event, so we'll be detailing, so we'll be starting with something a little different. Usually Glimpses in the Empire focuses firmly on Roman history, but I wrote a special episode just for this. So we are telling a story much older than the Roman Empire, from the days of the Greek city-states. And if there's anything Romans did, they loved ripping off shit from the Greeks. So this Glimpses into the Empire is outside of the Empire, and we will be talking about ancient Greece. So let us speak of Nebros the physician and the siege of Kira. It was a time of war. The sacred plain of Apollo was an important spiritual location for the pilgrims of many nations. However, these lands locally close to the kingdom of Kira, who was accused of sending out raiders to harass the pilgrims and steal from them while they were making their pilgrimage. These raids became so bad and so bold that eventually they crossed into the kingdom of Delphi, and that incident sparked an all-out war. Now, Delphi was a powerful nation with many allies, and they were gathered together into the Amphiaric League. When they attacked, the attack was led by Cleisthes of Sicyon, whose nation was not part of the League, but they were allied with it at the time. His powerful fleet blockaded the city of Kira, and the armies of the League laid siege to it. But Kira was very well defended, with ample stores, and easily resisted the initial waves of attack. It seemed that this was going to be a long and brutal endeavor, marked with high casualties. But during the siege, a horse took a bad step, broke through the pavement, and discovered a secret water pipe leading into the city of Kira. Now, Cleisthes summoned the army's chief physician, a doctor named Nebros, and asked him, "How can we best exploit this discovery?" So the doctor told him, "Well, if we block the water pipe, in a few days, they will be so weakened with thirst, they'll either surrender or be easily overcome by attack." "Good idea," he said, and they blocked up the water pipe. And the people in Kira did, in fact, suffer greatly with thirst, but they had ample stores of water, and that pipe was not the only one leading into the city. So although they suffered, they did not break, and they did not surrender. Now Nebros was summoned again and asked, "This is not working. What else can we do?" Now Nebros was a doctor, so he knew about medicines. Now, I like to think that he was conflicted in what he did, and then what he suggested was in an effort to save lives, but there's no way of knowing. Nebros advised his general to reopen the pipe and restore water to the city, but only after poisoning it with henbane. Now, henbane can be a deadly toxin, but in low doses, it just causes horrific diarrhea. And he thought, with everyone so debilitated, the attack would commence and the city would be easily taken, saving lives on both sides. I like to think that's what Nebros intended. So the water was poisoned and the pipe reopened, and soon the fountains within the besieged city flowed again, and the soldiers and the civilians drank deeply. And with a few hours, nearly everyone in Kira was quite ill from the effects of the henbane. Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh boy, I really hope they don't have a sound effect prepared for this. And that would be in very poor taste and beneath the dignity of this esteemed broadcast. But as I said earlier, this is a very special episode, so. As expected, those within Kira were too debilitated to properly withstand for an assault, and this time the invading armies easily overcame the defenders. Now, I'd like to think that Nebros had hoped this action would save lives and these people would have been taken captive and sold into slavery or ransomed, but that's not what happened. The invading army was so enraged and frustrated at the long siege that they slaughtered every man, woman, and child in Kira. It was a complete and utter massacre. Now, this is the first recorded use of what we would later call chemical weapons. And Nebros became famous as the doctor who destroyed a city. The doctor who used his art not to heal, but to kill. And no matter how many lives he saved after that day, he would only be remembered for that one dark deed. His name was forever tainted, no pun intended, by those actions, and so were his descendants for generations. Now, his family had a very proud tradition of passing on their medical training to their sons and daughters. So there were many generations of doctors after Nebros who followed his lineage, and they all bore the shame of his actions. Until one day, one of his descendants decided to write a standard ethical code of conduct for physicians, a sacred oath that they would swear at the end of their training, the chief among them would be to cause no harm. Now, this doctor, a descendant of Nebros, became even more famous, and his name is Hippocrates. And to this day, the Hippocratic Oath is still taken by physicians at the end of their training. So remember, even the most horrible tragedy, the most heinous of sins, can be the foundation for the noblest aspirations and become a true triumph of our collective humanity. Okay. Now, our next story is a fan favorite from season one. It nearly broke one of the hosts, who was very upset after it. And our story takes us to the province of Africa. In our daily struggle to put bread on the table, it is easy for us to forget the beautiful and magical world all around us. And for the most part, that's a very good thing, because people tend to destroy that which brings them joy. If we see a flower, we pluck it. No matter our intentions, eventually we bring ruin to the wondrous and magical things around us. It's sad and tragic, but it is our nature. So let me tell you about the dolphin of Hippozaritis. There lived a young boy in the town of Hippozaritis, in the province of Africa, in what you people will one day call Tunisia. He enjoyed swimming in the ocean, and one day while swimming, he noticed a shape moving in the water all around him. Now, the boy was more curious than cautious. I would have gotten out of the water. But he stayed and coaxed the strange thing towards him. And soon, the creature swam closer and closer until it could be clearly seen, and it was a dolphin. The boy began playing with his new, strange friend from the mysterious deep. They swam together, chased one another, and eventually the creature came close enough for the boy to touch, and then stroke, and then ride. And day after day, the boy played with the dolphin, and the dolphin eventually began coming when the boy called to it. Now, why did it come, and why did it stay? To this day, no one knows for sure. But I cannot help but think how brave that boy was and how amazing that experience must have been. And the people of this sleepy seaside town soon came to see the boy and his dolphins, and I'm sure at first with doubt and then with wonder, because many of them took to the water with the boy in hopes of making friends with the dolphin. They coaxed it closer with offerings of fish, and the creature ate from their hands and proved just as friendly to them as it did the boy. And for a time, magic and wonder came into all of their lives as they connected with something alien and beautiful. Soon word spread, and people from far and wide came to see this creature. And their sleepy seaside town was not so sleepy anymore. At first, these travelers were quite welcome, because the tourists brought with them coins. They rented rooms, purchased meals, shopped for trinkets to memorialize their trip. But then the truly wealthy and powerful found out about the dolphin of Hippo's Aretas, and they too came to see the now famous beast. Now, when common folk travel, they spend their own money. But when the wealthy and powerful visit some backwater town, it's a major event. Etiquette dictates that the town be courteous and generous hosts. So such esteemed visitors, often with their massive entourages, needed to be fed and housed and entertained, with all expenses laid upon the local government. And every time a noble visitor visited Hippo's Aretas, the town's coffer dwindled, and they just kept coming. Soon the town teetered on the edge of financial ruin, but they were trapped. They could not refuse to offer hospitality to the rich and powerful. It would be scandalous and leave a black mark in their town that would last for generations. So the town fathers met to discuss the urgent crisis and came up with a solution. This gentle, friendly visitor from the depths, who had harmed no one, was killed on the orders of the town fathers. It had become the only way to save the town without making enemies among the empire's elite. Soon the town faded back into obscurity, and its citizens were thankful for that. But still, I cannot help but think of that boy, the one who first made friends with the creature. I imagined he mourned his strange, beautiful friend, and I wonder if he blamed himself. Yes. I think they had to pause the show because one of the hosts was like,
"That was just a mess."
Yeah. Those poor, those terrible people. They were like, "Oh, we lost John." So yeah, that's a big fan favorite from season one. So here's a tale from season two, which aired a few weeks ago, about a demigod. Have you ever met someone who made a claim that was just so outrageous you couldn't believe it, or a promise you were sure they'd never keep? And have they ever surprised you by being as good as their word? Let us return to the days when the dreaded Cilician pirates were the scourge of Mare Nostrum and their encounter with a demigod. In the waning days of the Republic, or as Mare Nostrum, or as you people call it, the Mediterranean Sea, was a dangerous place. These waters were infested by the pirates of Cilicia, a land on the southern shores of Asia Minor. These pirates would attack ships, steal their cargoes, slay their crews, and either hold captive for ransom or sell their passengers into slavery. And Rome turned a blind eye to all of this. Why? Because the wealthy and powerful took bribes from the pirates and bought these slaves at steep discounted prices. But then one day, these pirates captured a young nobleman who was just 22 years old. He was on his way home from Greece after studying law. He was from an old and prominent family, but they had fallen on hard times. Their captive was no one of consequence, but still they hoped to make some profit on him. And they demanded a ransom of 20 talents of gold for his freedom. Now, that may mean nothing to you, but I looked up the conversion, and 20 talents of gold is about $28 million today. And the boy was furious, but not for the reasons you'd think. He asked, "Do you know who I am? I am descended from the goddess Venus herself," naming himself as a demigod. And he informed them that their asking price for his freedom was insulting, and he demanded that they raise it to 50 talents of gold. And I looked up the conversion again, and that's about $78 million today. The pirates were very amused, so they agreed and raised raised their ransom demand to 50 talents of gold. And they released some of the nobleman's servants to raise the amount, while he remained with them as a guest at their base. For the next 38 days, the boy lived with the pirates, some of the most murderous brigands on earth. During that time, the boy made himself quite at home. If he was trying to sleep and the pirates were too noisy, he would tell them to shut up. He practiced his speeches, he wrote some poetry, and then he would recite these to the pirates, and if they criticized his effort, he'd call them illiterate savages. He ate with them, played sports with them, gambled with them, and made them laugh so much it seemed that he was almost their leader than a prisoner. And through it all, he reminded them of one thing. You know, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to come back and I'm going to kill every last one of you. And they laughed at his joke, but he assured them, oh, this is not a joke. This is a promise. At the end of that 38 days, the 50 talents for his ransom did, in fact, arrive. And almost immediately, the boy was released, and almost immediately, he came back, leading an army of well-paid mercenaries. The pirates were so stunned, they hadn't even moved their camp. They were so taken by surprise, nearly all of them were captured. And the boy warned them, I did warn you this was coming. Not only did he capture the pirates, he captured all of their treasure, including the ransom. And as the boy prepared to hang the pirates, he thought, you know, maybe I'm overstepping my authority. So instead of hanging them, he took them, dumped them in a local prison, and went to see the local governor of Asia, a Marcus Junius. As the region's ranking Roman official, it was Marcus Junius's duty to punish these pirates. However, the meeting took a very sour turn. The governor hesitated, saying he needed time to investigate this matter before handing down any judgments. Now, the boy knew of the corruption going on, and he had heard about the bribes these pirates often gave to the rich and powerful, but he didn't think it went as far as the local governor. So, when he left the meeting, he went straight back to the prison, and he reclaimed the pirates. It's hard to refuse someone leading an army of well-paid mercenaries. And he then crucified every last one of them. A promise is a promise, and a demigod's promise is even more so. Now, this boy then went on to have quite a notable career as both a politician and a general. He inspired people with a charm that was a credit to Venus herself, and luck that showed the favor of the gods. He became a consul of Rome, conquered Gaul, led an army to Britannia, and then led it back across the Rubicon when he changed the world forever. And this boy's name was Gaius Julius Caesar. So remember, sometimes an outrageous claim is just a harmless joke, and other times it can be a dire warning. It's not always easy to tell the two apart. All right, so this next story hasn't aired yet, so you're getting a sneak preview. It should be out on Monday. And it is called Tutula, Savior of Rome. When all seems lost, it's easy to lose hope. But history reminds us that these are the moments where heroes are made. And not all heroes are born into noble families with long and prestigious lineages. Some arise from the most humble of origins, but they leave their mark on history. So let us now speak of a slave girl, Tutula, who became the savior of Rome. It was a dark time for the Roman Republic. Rome had just fallen, sacked by the Gauls in battle. One of Rome's neighboring tribes, the Latins, took advantage of this opportunity and attacked the Romans. Weakened by their battles against the Gauls, the Romans were easily defeated. And the Latins demanded that the Romans surrender their unmarried women and widows as terms of their surrender. With their armies exhausted and their position hopeless, the Romans were forced to accept these abhorrent terms. And in that moment stepped forward a slave girl called Tutula. Tutula claimed that she could save the free women of Rome and help the Romans achieve victory over the Latins. She had a plan, but they must work fast. Desperate for anything resembling hope, Carmillus, leader of the Romans, ordered that Tutula's plan be followed. The fate of Rome, which hung by a thread, now was entrusted to a lowly slave girl and her daring plan. Tutula instructed the free women of Rome to exchange clothing with their slave girls. Now the slave girls, along with Tutula, were then given to the Latins, and they were marched off shedding false tears and feigning terror at their sudden turn of fate. And as sunset approached, the Latins made camp and took stock of their captives. The Latin soldiers were completely unaware of the deception and began distributing these women amongst themselves, and the plan was in motion. The Latins started celebrating their victory and the humiliation they'd inflicted upon the Romans. The free women of Rome were forced to serve their new masters, pouring them wine, and the women encouraged these men to drink deeply. They danced with them and endured their ignoble attentions as the revelry lasted long into the night. And the free Roman women soon fell asleep from the wine they'd drunk and the ordeal they'd experienced, and their new masters soon followed suit. However, these slave girls had hardy constitutions, and they knew how to hold their wine. And they only pretended to be drunk and fall asleep. And as the Latin soldiers slept, these slave girls rose and began hiding their weapons and armor. All except one, because Tutula had an even more dangerous objective. After she'd freed herself from her captive, she crept out into the enemy camp. And silent as a shadow, she stole an unlit torch and then found the highest point in the enemy camp, an olive tree atop a hill. She climbed to the top of the tree, lit the torch, and held it high above her head. And that was the signal the Romans were waiting for. As the Latins marched off to celebrate their victory long into the night, the exhausted Roman army was having a much-needed rest. They rose for battle well after sunset and waited for the signal, a lone torch in the darkness, a single glimmer of hope. This showed them not only the location of the Latins' camp, but indicated that their enemy would both be unarmed and drunk. At a quick yet quiet march, the Romans surrounded the Latins' camp and attacked. The Romans were now rested and still angry over their earlier humiliation. Caught by surprise, drunk and fatigued from celebrating, with many unable to locate their arms, the Latins attempted to stage a defense, but it was no use. They were annihilated, and the Romans recovered their slave girls. Thanks to the bravery and cunning of Tutula, the Romans' fortunes had finally changed. Tutula was immediately freed, and all of the slave girls involved in this were rewarded. A day of feasts and games were held in their honor, and centuries later, the day is still celebrated as the holiday Capretina, where female slaves have a parade wielding olive branches, then a mock battle around an olive tree, before various games and feasts are held in their honor. Few even remember why we celebrate Capretina, but this is the reason. So never let yourself forget that true greatness is not a matter of gender, wealth, or social standing. True greatness beats within the heart of every man and woman who chooses to make themselves a hero. Now we will end tonight's performance with a fan favorite also from season one, entitled The Black Heart of Vettius Pullio. The hearts of men are as varied as the shells upon a seashore. Some shine with color, some are jagged and broken, others are dull and unspectacular, but every once in a while you'll find a shell as black as a moonless night sky. And such was the heart of Vettius Pullio. Vettius Pullio was a freedman, which means he had been born a slave, but was now free. Good fortune had shined upon him, and he'd amassed a considerable fortune through commerce. Vettius even earned his way into the ranks of the noble equestrians due to his wealth. Now one would think so lucky a man would be generous and good-natured. Some would think that he'd be a man who'd own few slaves, as he had been a slave himself. Or if he did own slaves, he would be exceedingly kind to the few he did own. However, the truth was quite the opposite. Vettius owned many slaves, and became famous for his sadistic cruelty towards them. Another thing he was famous for was his fondness for eating Morania, those long, slimy, blood-sucking eels that I think you people call lampreys. Many consider them a delicacy, but I can't stand the thought of disgusting things. Vettius had a massive pool constructed at his villa where he raised lampreys for his kitchen. But I think the main reason he kept the pool was to terrorize his slaves. You see, when a slave displeased Vettius, he would have them thrown to the lampreys. The vicious creatures would then latch on to the screaming slave and begin draining them of blood. The victims would weaken from blood loss as they were being eaten alive until they could no longer tread water and drown. And this happened so often that some of these lampreys grew to incredible size, fattened on human blood. And Vettius took great pleasure in eating the lampreys that had eaten those who had so displeased him. Now, somehow, such a despicable person was also the friend of divine Augustus, our first emperor. And one day, Augustus was dining at the house of Vettius Pullio, and it was a grand affair. All the best finery the household had to offer was on full display, when suddenly a slave boy, who was serving, accidentally broke a fine goblet of crystal. Vettius, as was his nature, flew into a rage and ordered that the child be thrown to the lampreys. The hysterical boy wriggled out of the grasp of the guards and threw himself at the feet of divine Augustus, and he begged. He did not beg for his life. Oh no, he was not that proud. He begged to be killed cleanly, with mercy, and not to be devoured by the blood-sucking horrors in his master's pool. Augustus was shocked, and he'd seen enough. He ordered the boy immediately freed from slavery and that he not be punished. The emperor then ordered that every item of fine crystal in the household be shattered, and that all the broken shards be thrown into the lamprey pool. And then when that was done, for the nightmarish pool to be filled in with concrete. The emperor then chastised Vettius, saying a man's life should not be given up to unheard of torture over a broken cup, and that he must think quite a great deal of himself to act this way in front of his emperor. As all men, both good and bad, eventually do, Vettius died as one of the most hated men in the empire. He left much land to Augustus, with many grand buildings upon them, with instructions that these properties be used for the public good. Augustus accepted the land, but tore down every building upon them so there would be no monument to bear the name of Vettius Pullio. Today, his name is known only for the cruelty of his deeds and how he was put in his place by the divine Augustus. So remember, in the end, you will not be remembered for your wealth or property, but how you treated your fellow human beings, especially those you held power over. Thank you for joining me for this evening. I hope you enjoy the rest of Carnage. This has been an evening of glimpses into the Empire. Yours, in service to the Empire, Ascarius Tabularis.